You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 310, a post-election special. How did we do with her predictions? Oh dear. We look back at Thursday night's television coverage and recall the highlights and the lowlights. And we'll tell you how the role of the press in British elections has changed forever. It's all coming up after Todd Rundgren and Just One Victory.
Now, you'll just have to forgive me here. I only pick a track from my musical hero about once a year, and this somehow seemed apposite from his gloriously titled 1973 album, A Wizard, A True Star. That's Todd Rundgren and Just One Victory. Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 310. I'm Terence Stackham, and she's our First Lord of the Treasury. It's Juliet Harris.
Yes, that is Lord Harris to you. Thank you. Good afternoon / morning / evening / I don't even know what day it is anymore.
I imagine not. There's many of us have barely slept since Thursday. Now, Jules, it turns out, surprise of all surprises, that we were miles out with our predictions.
Yes, anybody that experienced our football predictions really ought to have predicted this, shouldn't they, really?
Yeah, well, when the election was first called, we said that there would be a Conservative majority of 50, in my case, 68 you. But if we were off target, my goodness, then many media commentators were so far away they were in a different galaxy. As late as 5 minutes before the polls closed and the exit poll was revealed, I noticed Alison Pearson of The Telegraph and Piers Morgan from The Flames of Hell were...
to be fair, Alison Pearson seems to get nearer to those each time she tweets.
Well, they both tweeted that they confidently expected, at 5 to 10, they confidently expected a landslide victory, a Tory majority of 120, they both said. Yet again, when the exit poll was revealed... there were politicians, the hapless, indeed Michael Fallon amongst them, suggesting that, the stats must be wrong, they were saying. But Mr Corbyn and his Labour team did far, far better than anyone might have predicted. So as a Labour supporter, and not really a Corbyn follower at all, I'm wondering how you feel, elated because it was so much better than you could ever have expected, or deflated because... so near yet so far, both in your local work, because you've been working very hard down in Hastings, and of course the national picture.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I'm going to split this into two, I think. Hastings and Rye, and then nationally. So I spent all of election day, so Thursday, from 10 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock in the evening, sat in someone's house with a laptop, and basically my job was to try and get Labour votes out, and we were sending people to knock up, we were putting in data from polling stations. I went into this, as everyone knows, with no expectations at all. I thought there'd be a Tory majority. I could just point out, firstly, Tory private polling and Labour private polling on Monday night and Tuesday were both pointing to a Tory majority around the 50 to 60 mark. So their predictions matched our predictions, yeah. Their internal polling. Also, I said beforehand that YouGov, who were the only pollster that properly predicted this, them and Servation on the day, I said all along their methodology was so different to everyone else's, they were either geniuses or fools. I had them down as fools, and it turns out they were geniuses. Sorry, YouGov. So I had no expectations that we would win in Hastings and Rye, and I noticed two patterns as I was putting in my data. The first, well, three really. Firstly, the turnout was very high, and that was what we were hearing from everywhere. And the turnout in Hastings went up by about, several percent. So it was a high turnout election. When people were coming back from having knocked on doors, we were mostly running off 2015 data. We did do some canvassing for local elections, but the bulk of our data, I suspect, had come from 2015. The second group was young voters and people that hadn't previously voted. So our copy of the electoral register the marked register that we worked off, only dated from March. So it didn't take into account the huge number of people that rushed to register to vote, the vast majority of which were young after the election was called in April. And I noticed that about every time someone we input a slip, so by this I mean that we had people called tellers outside polling stations. So when you walk into a polling station, there'll be someone in a rosette outside that will go, "Excuse me, can I have your number off your poll card, please?" And so they write those numbers down on slips. We've got a man that goes around on a moped on election day who then comes in every so often and brings, I love our local party, comes in and brings Peter's Magic Moped. he goes around and does that, and then he comes back and brings the slips in for me. And so I was getting data quite regularly, and then my long-suffering deputy Richard in the polling room, or occasionally it was my friend Michael's house, his kids would occasionally, we were not above child labour, they would occasionally come in and give the slips off to me, because they wanted to be fair. They were very excited. But so we were doing that, and I noticed that every so often, Rich would give me a number, and it was two, and I noticed it was higher numbers wouldn't go in, and it said no vote, you know, no data, no voter data. So gradually, I worked out, and I wished I'd taken better note of this. But about three numbers, say per slip, weren't going in. So there were 30 numbers on a slip, and we probably input something in the region of 80 slips. So I sat and worked out that actually of roughly 2,400 voters that we had voting, 15% of those were young people, young people, previously non-voters, which was a huge, huge thing. And that matched our anecdotal data of people that were going to polling stations, and all the tellers were telling Peter, it's really, really busy and there are loads of young people, loads of young people. I didn't have to queue to vote, but then that's because I went at 7:10. But so that was interesting. And I said that it would come down to which group was bigger, Labour to Tory switchers or young people who were overwhelmingly voting Labour, by the way. That was all the data that we were getting. My canvassers were young. My canvassers were people I'd never seen before. There was huge enthusiasm. It did feel like we were on a bit of a roll. And so I watched it all night on telly with a friend of mine, and the funniest thing was when David Dimbleby said, you know, and blah, 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 and we are hearing that Amber Rudd is in some difficulty in Hastings and Rye, and in my head I went 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, at which point my phone went ping, 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 as everyone I knew around the country were messaging, going, is it true? Is it true? Are you at the count, Juliet? Juliet, what's going on? Hi, Juliet. I know I haven't spoken to you for ages. Have you got on Hastings and Rye? And so, I mean, in the end, it was, you know, the local party worked really hard, and there were people that were basically howling at the moon we didn't win. And I feel a little bit like a kind of an outcast, in the sense that it was really frustrating that we got so close and didn't get her out, because I think Amber Rudd is an appalling constituency MP, and actually so does a lot of Hastings, it turns out.
So it seems, yes.
But ultimately, I'm not as rawly heartbroken as everybody else is, because I went into it with no expectations. I think so in a way that is weird. The national picture, yes, you're right. I mean, my biggest opposition to Corbyn was I didn't think it would work, and I didn't think he was electable. He did much better than you and I thought he'd do.
Absolutely.
He didn't lose much of our core, which we thought we would do previously. You know, in that sense, he did really well. We still didn't win.
No.
And ultimately, and I know I'm probably going to get egged from lots of people saying this, there's no question of Corbyn going now at all. No, he increased seats, he increased vote share. That's fine. And on that basis, he should stay to fight another day. However, I said a week ago, if you can't beat Theresa May, I don't think you can beat anyone. I don't. It was the worst Tory campaign in living memory. Everyone is agreed on that now. It was horrendous. And I struggle to think that they were, the Tories are ruthless, and I struggle to think they'll ever let it be that bad again. Yes, Labour did do really well. It's being painted as a great victory, of course, by the Labour leadership. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that I think the Tories lost it rather than Labour winning it. Labour thought there'd been lots of, I mean, Paul Mason's made some ridiculous statements this morning about how Blairites diverted funding away from marginals. The reason that was done is because all of the polling data, including the private polling data, was suggesting that we had to shore up our heartlands. And actually, a lot of Labour MPs ran really good local campaigns, which Corbyn was kept out of and didn't visit, and they held on to those seats. Corbyn had a fantastic campaign in many cases. I believe that, and I believe he should stay. But I am just a bit concerned that whether or not all the young people voting, is this how it's going to be now, this election, or was this genuinely a once-in-a-lifetime post-Brexit event? Because this is either the start of the Corbyn surge, or it's the high point of it. And I hope that it's the former rather than the latter.
Yeah, it's always rather tempting to make big judgments immediately after an election, and I've made that mistake myself before. But I think it is fair to say that very many people previously critical of Mr. Corbyn, including me, did warm to him personally during the campaign. He came across to me as a kind of floating voter, I must say, really, once the campaign got away. He came across to me in a similar way to Bernie Sanders in the Democrats' election campaign in America. And I think despite the age gap, I think he also fell into the same populist groove that attracted Canadians to Justin Trudeau and the French voters more recently to Emmanuel Macron. But it does feel to me at the moment, as I say, don't make sweeping statements, but here I go. It does feel like there's a shift away from the class division of the governing people, Mrs. May, very old-fashioned politician who believes earnestly, yes, that she knows what's best for us all, and we should just all jolly well trust in her and leave her alone to get on with it, without the troublesome business of appearing in public or costing her, yes, manifesto pledges.
And she came across really badly, and that's where Corbyn really showed her up, I think.
That's right. And although unlikely, though, it seemed at one point, Mr. Corbyn seems more at ease under pressure.
Oh, absolutely.
As a leader of a political movement as well. And young people in particular, as you said, saw through Mrs. May's evasive manner and rather took to Mr. Corbyn, who spoke well and, I think importantly, was ever willing to speak with people, pose for selfies, appear
absolutely
human. However, just like the Brexit referendum a year ago, this has been another exercise in splitting the British people and causing division.
Absolutely,
and unhappiness.
Yeah.
Rather than Mrs. May's stated aim of bringing unity, now her move since the election to try and bring some sense of government has involved what I'm calling the Bad Friday Agreement with the DUP.
Yeah, and this is just, I mean, this shows really what a place Theresa May is in. I mean, I don't want to get into potentially libelous speculation as to why she's in the place that she seems to be at the moment. Interesting. I decided I'd do this on Friday or Saturday. The last day has lasted for about 3 days, but at some point during the last day, I listened to her Desert Island Discs from 2014 because I thought it would be an interesting thing to do. And it was almost like listening to a different person. She did avoid a direct question from Kirsty Young about whether or not she wanted to take over from David Cameron in the future. And Kirsty Young did pick her up on the fact she'd avoided the question, but that's perhaps, understandable. But she came across as someone that was very religious and her faith was important to her. She was authentic in that most of the stuff she picked was hymns. She picked an ABBA record because she said that she and her husband were very much of the ABBA generation and picked Dancing Queen. And she picked something, she picked Walk Like a Man by the Four Seasons because she said that it reminded her of her and her husband spending time with friends in their village hall. And she came across as someone that, yes, was very driven by a sense of public duty, but Kirsty Young asked her what her favourite top was to go out in when she was younger, and she laughed, and she was quite, she had humour about her, and she was reasonably, I heard it at the time and I was left thinking, I don't agree with this woman's politics, but I do agree that she is sincere. And that was how she was initially marketed, as someone that was a bit of a grafter, that was very sincere and, had a sense of duty. And that seems to have spiralled off into this, as you say, this I know best, holding on at all costs to align with the DUP and to throw the Northern Ireland peace process, which is one of the biggest achievements of the Blair government, I think. I will never stop talking about that. We talked about it last week, in fact, on this very podcast. I was pretty angry with her anyway for calling a general election that we didn't need. And actually, weirdly, it turns out so were a lot of people. And I'm even crosser with her now for be willing to jeopardise the Northern Ireland peace process, which John Major in 92, even before that happened, John Major's got some very strong views on this and how, you have to keep out of it. You need to keep out of Northern Ireland if you're Westminster, because that's what you need to do. And that was even before the power sharing agreement. By the way, the power sharing sharing agreement is in collapse at the moment. This is, but and you know, no one thought of that when calling a snap general election. And the idea is that there is no executive in place in Northern Ireland at the moment. There have been several goes for Arlene Foster to resign, and she won't because of this Cash for Ash scandal, which is still one of my favourite scandal names.
It's a great name, but in actual fact, I haven't seen enough publicity given to this. It is an absolutely extraordinary story when you look at the waste of money.
It's a cesspit of corruption. And now Theresa May is trying to go into coalition with this woman. And there are lots of Tory MPs that are very unhappy about this. Do not underestimate the anger that is in the Tory parliamentary party at the moment. Anna Soubry, I mean, I have to say, Anna Soubry is one of those people that it's okay to like, I think, even if you're not a Tory. When we were watching the election night coverage, I interviewed her about five or half five, I think it was daylight hours. And I was just about to go to the loo, and they got Anna Soubry on, and she started talking. And my friend said, oh, you don't want to miss Anna Soubry. I'm like, no, but I do really need a wee. And I got up, and I did that thing where she was sat on the sofa, and I was stood up, and I was watching telly when you're standing up as you're on the move, and David Bimbusi said, what do you think went wrong in the campaign? And Anna Soubry went, well, where do you want me to start? And my friend went, sit down. And I sat down because I thought, I don't care if I do really need a toilet. This is worth watching. And there was a lot of anger. And it was interesting, the change in tone from Theresa May, that went from basically behaving as if nothing had happened when she gave that speech, saying, I'm going to form a government and we need stability.
Let's get back to work.
Yeah, well, even before that, the initial speech when she said, I think it's really important for stability, which case, love, why did you call the election in the first place? But so we went from that, and then she gave a further speech in which she said, and I am sorry for the ministers that lost their seats, they didn't deserve to. And apparently there was anger in the Tory party that people, quite popular figures in some cases, and Anna Soubry herself came, the Labour were briefing that they thought they'd won Broxbourne early on in the evening, and she only held on by about 800 votes. Amber Rudd, of course, I've talked about my Hastings and Rye perception of that, but you know, the Home Secretary nearly lost her seat, who's meant to be, and this has rather put paid to her any prime ministerial ambitions that she might have had, so I had a lot of people thanking me anyway on Friday, I have to say. Justine Greening, her other trusted lieutenant, who gave a very thoughtful interview, I thought. She's a very thoughtful figure, Justine Greening. In Putney, Putney, of all places, went from a majority of 10,000 to 1,500. So all of Theresa May's gang, Ben Gummer lost his seat. So all of her kind of favoured gang are, you know, completely in disarray. And I mean, It's you know, I don't see that her position is sustainable long term. Heidi Allen, who's one of the more thoughtful backbenchers for the Tories, has come out and said she thinks 6 months tops. My contacts were getting texts at 3 o'clock in the morning saying Boris is already on manoeuvres. You know, whether or not that will work, I don't know. And I think the Tories are in a position where the reason why Theresa May got in the first place, let's be honest, with that list of five, she was seen as not the most appealing prospect, but the least unappealing prospect, and I don't think very much has changed. I can't think of any alternative leaders for the Tories at the moment. This is my prediction, and I'm sure lots of my Labour supporting friends listening to this podcast will shout at me for being a scab at this point, because I'm going to imagine what I would do if I was a Tory strategist or a Tory MP at this point. You know what I'd be doing? You know who had a good election for the Tories? Who had the best election for the Tories? Ruth Davidson in Scotland. They picked up lots of Scottish seats, and they, as did Labour, to be fair. And I have to say, I was delighted by the comeuppance of the SNP. I don't think that they are radical kind of leftists that they're painted out. I think they are one-trick ponies that are fixated on independence and will do anything to get it. And 10 years of SNP rule in Scotland has resulted in horrendous education standards where they've gone backwards, and people have finally had enough. We did open a new bottle of wine at 4 o'clock in the morning when Salmon lost his seat. That was particularly wonderful. The Tory figure that has been an MP in Scotland for ages and ages and ages, who isn't a new one, David Mundell, is a Scottish MP. He won that seat. He's been Under Secretary of State for Scotland for ages. He won that seat in 2005. If I was a Tory MP, I'd be saying to David Mundell, I think you're brilliant. You know what you could do that would quite possibly save the Tory party at this point in time? Why don't you stand down as an MP and trigger a by-election, Ruth Davidson will win it and win that seat and then have a Westminster seat. She will take over as leader of the Conservative Party in Britain and she'll win easily next time. I think that at the moment, Ruth Davidson doesn't have a talk. I think she's got some limitations, don't get me wrong. She talks before she thinks sometimes, which, like Boris, can sometimes be very charming and sometimes it isn't very charming at all. But she is particularly anti the DUP because, of course, she's openly gay. She said, as you know, a Protestant who's about to marry a sort of a Catholic. She's very clear on that. I think in terms of the Tories want someone that can win the next election, which could be very soon. Under the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, there are 2 weeks to form a government. And if a government cannot be formed within 2 weeks under the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, there's a general election again instantly. So, you know, hang on to your horses, everyone. Don't put those rosettes and stickers back in the loft just yet, because we could be doing this again. But if the Tories wanted to win the next election, I think the only other option, I mean, they're keeping Theresa May in place through a lack of other options and, of course, the Brexit dimension as well, but the only person I could see winning election for the Tories right now is Ruth Davidson.
Next, we'll be looking at how television and radio performed on election night, and we'll highlight one or two of the strange moments of the coverage. That's next, after a track chosen by Juliet, which I think has some significance in its title. It's The Smiths.
Typical me, I started something, and now I'm not too
I'm sorry, but although I'm angry about the DUP and that has rather taken the gloss off now. Oh, God, it was so funny, wasn't it? And I have to say, that was the Smiths, by the way, and I started something I couldn't finish. Oh, typical me. I was so entertained by the fact that Theresa May goes into an election. It was a very British election. She goes in saying, you know, I am the supreme leader. Only I can do this. I'm going to get a massive majority. And the British electorate goes, you know what, love? No. Also, regulars as I'm a huge fan of the New Statesman podcast. So Stephen Bush and Helen Lewis did one on the morning of Friday. It's so funny. So Helen Lewis claims to have had 3 hours sleep and Stephen Bush hasn't had any. And it starts with one of them going, woo! And then very much, apparently when the exit poll broke, the New Statesman staff party all sang Do You Hear the People Sing? Which is just great. But there's a lovely bit where Helen Lewis talks about another, which went on after, you know, if Theresa May calls another election to increase her own majority, at which point Helen Lewis breaks into uncontrollable laughter for a solid 20 seconds as Stephen Bush continues the podcast. And it is just so funny. And as Stephen Bush puts it, this is never not going to be funny, what's happened, really. And from an English point of view, poor old Theresa May, who ended up stood next to Lord Buckethead, who, by the way, I might have voted for had I lived in Maidenhead. His platform was a lot more sensible. I mean, obviously the bring back CFAX ticket was the kind of headline policy for me, but his votes, he proposed lowering the voting age to 16 and capping it at 80, which I think is an entirely sensible approach. So you know, it's just really Lord Buckethead. But you know, it is, and that picture of Theresa May at one end and Elmo at the other, and this could be a conspiracy theory, but I think they put Theresa May in red expecting a victory so that then they could say, oh, she's parked her tanks on Labour's lawn. And instead what ended up was you had Theresa May in red at one end of the photograph and Elmo in red at the other end of the photograph. if ever you wanted a picture of Theresa May's hubris coming home to roost, it's that, I think.
One of the first clips to go viral immediately after the polls closed was in studio footage from BBC Radio 5 Live, when Chris Mason and Stephen Nolan saw the results of the exit poll just before they went on air. And the atmosphere of astonishment in the studio was palpable. And this was also the mood in the TV studios just after 10 o'clock on the BBC. David Dimbleby presented the exit poll news to a rather ashen-faced Michael Fallon.
Yes.
And a rather chirpier John McDonnell. And
yes.
He had, though, more success with these two than he did later in the night with a very bright and breezy Emily Thornberry.
I have to say, we didn't see anything on the election coverage that beat this. It was absolutely incredible. I cannot find full footage of this interview online. Please, someone put it up, because it is so good.
Well, she was remarkably busy, as I say, and on being told that the Conservatives still expected to win a majority, this was about 3 o'clock in the morning, something like that, she leaned back.
Much earlier than that. It was much earlier in the evening than that. It was between 12 and 1. It wasn't that deep into the evening. It was very early on.
She leaned back and she smiled slowly and she said, she was just told, oh, they still expect a big majority. And she just said, well, there we are.
And it was the grin that made it. Well,
huge grin. The bit
in... And Dimbleby had to shut the interview down, I think, at that point, because he realised that he just wasn't going to win. By the way, there were lots of speculation on Twitter as to whether she'd had a gin or two. That was someone that was absolutely plastered with tiredness. She was just off her face with not having slept, clearly, and also was obviously quite relieved and elated, I think,
absolutely,
as well, because it was not the night they were expecting. One of the sources I had from the Labour private polling was from someone whose brother works for Emily Thornberry. So actually, probably she was, I mean, that was brilliant, as was Dimbleby trying to swat the fly away, Dimbleby being crashed by the photobombed by a tea lady by accident, and also the BBC coverage. I would have been perhaps better, although it very entertaining for us, that they didn't bother to mute Dimbleby's microphone when they went to show footage of counts, which meant you'd have someone winning somewhere and of Dimbleby going, "Who is this man?" underneath, and also him going bloody hell when they lost their seat in, when one of the Labour won a seat in Scotland. So so yes, the Emily Thornberry interview was pretty epic. The two interviews that bookended the coverage for me, her and Anna Soubry.
Yes,
very honest, and both not taking any rubbish at all.
The BBC TV coverage was odd. It was
a bit bizarre, to be fair.
It was beset with audio problems, not only in relaying the results live from each count, where we often couldn't hear what the returning officer was saying.
And he was quick to blame the counts rather than them.
As you said, the really strange business, which you think you might happen once, but they kept repeating it, of keeping David Dimbleby's microphone open when he believed it was muted. So we did get several mild swears and muttering from Dimbleby at each count. But the most peculiar audio issue on the BBC was Emily Maitlis's shoes.
Everyone's talking about this, and we didn't spot this. We never experienced this.
Well, standing at a screen in the studio explaining the significance of results, each time, because she was standing, each time she took a step backward or forward, her shoe squeaked, and it was like she was trampling on mice. It was like a Monty Python sketch. So she was saying, "Well, now I'm just going to look at the change in Canterbury," and you did.
I'm genuinely sorry that I missed this. Can I also say, by the way, our absolute favourite unexpected bit of the BBC election coverage, and it made us laugh so much. Anyone that's ever worked in a workplace and, you know, experienced rivalries between colleagues and, you know, discipline and whatnot will have some sympathy. They started interviewing Chuka Umna, about the evening, and at the same time, eventually, they started showing the Hastings and Rye count underneath and were deafened by me and my friend shouting, "Shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up," at Chuka, which I'm sorry, Chuka, but I really wanted to see the Hastings and Rye result. I knew at this point that Amber was likely to have just held on. I had sources at the count that told me that the first count had gone her way, but Labour had asked for a recount because they had nothing to lose, and I agree. But there was a lovely bit where, as Chuka was talking, they had a split screen. So they had Chuka on the left, and then they had the split screen on the right, which eventually had the Hastings and Rye count on it. But briefly, for no apparent reason, halfway through, they cut to footage of the upstairs bit, you know, where all the people were working in the background, and they showed a woman putting, this is about sort of quarter to five, when things were still in play at this point, putting a coat on, speaking to a colleague, and then just walking out, and literally she was saying, "Oh, I'm off home now, bye," and it had this awful kind of lime green puffer jacket, and we thought it was hysterical, and my friend said, "Oh my goodness, you know, that cameraman, who is clearly really bitter at the thought that they still probably have 3 hours left on this, has gone right." The news of, you know, a colleague possibly leaving prematurely and showing them on national TV. So a colleague dumping on another, even at a time of great national importance. And also, we pictured a disciplinary meeting on Monday where green-coated woman's line manager has said, "Now, I've told you before that coat isn't appropriate for this office." So that was one of our favourite moments of detail from the BBC coverage.
Excellent. It was good to see Laura Koonsberg given a more visible and useful role on election night.
She's brilliant. She was really, really good.
Last time she was often ignored and she was reduced to tweet reader outer in 2015. This time they had...
She had some really, really fly commentary.
Yeah, this time they had media editor Amal Rajan on Twitter patrol.
Absolutely. And Kirsty Wark in Scotland wearing the most incomprehensible dress I've ever seen. So the funniest thing about Laura Koonsberg, and I mean, we were saying that Laura Koonsberg is just phenomenal. Her energy, and in terms of her staying on air for, I mean, she's famous right now, isn't she, for many hours on end. And the best bit was when they said to her, half seven in the morning, Dimbleby looking visibly rumpled by this point. we said Dimbleby was meant to be retiring, and obviously gone, "Oh, I'll just do one more. You know, it's going to be a large majority. I'll get home early. What's the worst that could happen?" Dimbleby, who looked visibly just exhausted and angry by about 7 o'clock in the morning, said to Laura Koonsberg, who'd been up all night and was still, you know, very much on it and very sharp. And he said to her, "So are you going to go to Downing Street then?" And she went, "Yes," in such an overexcited way. She was like a child. I'd expected her to say, "And then we're going for ice cream afterwards." She was so excited about it. And, you know, everyone else in that studio, I think, was just willing to go off and die at that point. And she was visibly excited at the thought that she was going to go and live the story. And when Theresa May turned up, the first voice you heard shouting at her was Laura Koonsberg. And Laura Koonsberg's got such a whacking from the left during this election. She's become a real figure of hate. And actually, I never agreed with that, and I don't particularly now, because she's been giving Theresa May a very hard time over the last 2 or 3 weeks, and you know, all power to her. I thought she came across really well, and actually she was so sharp and so on it that I would like to see her replace Dimbleby next time.
Good, interesting point.
At that role.
Over on Sky, their coverage felt a little lackluster. We kind of know what to expect from Sky. Bolton grinning in the studio and Kay Burley being dramatic out on location somewhere.
And Sophie Rich, who actually I think is probably the most sensible person at Sky, I think.
I agree with you. Kay Burley was in Maidenhead, this time at the Magnet Leisure Centre, along, as you've said earlier, with a bloke dressed as Elmo and another fellow with a bucket on his head. On ITV, Tom Bradby hosted what turned out to be the Ed Balls and George Osborne show.
Which he nearly stuck with, because that was very tempting, and apparently they were very good.
Well, Osborne was almost gleeful at the as the full picture of Conservative losses he made.
That is funny. That's not that attractive, is it? Really?
No, well, although the Osborne-Balls combo was sort of faintly amusing, ITV did, rely too heavily on their sort of interaction, which it did become weary after a while. But there was, a strange thing on ITV. They weren't as weary as Tom Bradby himself. He had to keep jumping up from the desk and walk across the studio, across a wooden floor, to a strange sort of breakout area to intergroup groups of guests who were sort of shuffled in to give Ed and George a break. So I think, despite the audio issues, and David Dimbleby, as you said, increasingly getting tetchy as the night wore on.
And that was obviously really funny from the viewpoint of people, me and my friend, who have both been campaigning all day and basically drank our way through the evening with red wine. We thought that was extremely entertaining, which it was, but it wasn't very pleasant, let's face it.
No, I'm just about calling it a win for the BBC overall, I think. Now, the role of the press in British elections has changed forever, and we'll tell you how right after this track from a new album by Dan Auerbach.
I'm not afraid to die.
Widely known for his work with the Black Keys. That's a splendid track from the new album from Dan Auerbach. The album is Waiting on a Song, and that was King of a One-Horse Town.
I heard that playing in a local record shop the other day, and I thought it was really good. And actually, I couldn't work out who it was. And when I asked the chap behind the counter who it was, and he said it was Dan Auerbach, I said, oh, that's why this sounds so much like the Black Keys then.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Now, we've been hearing for years that print media is on a steady decline to oblivion, and perhaps a rather heavy boot kicked these print titles with even more force this week. And as usual, several of the national papers in the UK ran scare stories about the Labour Party and their leadership, including the usual cartoons portraying Mr Corbyn in the worst possible light. But it seems they made virtually no difference at all, particularly, I'm guessing, among young people who increasingly don't rely on daily newspapers for opinion or news. But perhaps, I think even more significantly, targeted advertising on social media. On Facebook, it's possible to target videos and adverts to specific areas and constituencies.
Yeah, the demographics, yeah.
Exactly. So Facebook users in Tory target seats were treated to videos almost exclusively anti-Corbyn advertisements with George Orwell kind of undertones saying Corbyn isn't up to it and, you know, putting him in charge of risk to the country and so on. Yet these two seem to have had less impact than the Conservatives hoped, considering actually it's millions of pounds, because you can get round the electoral spending system on this. So they put millions of pounds into Facebook ads. And that's why I say the media, including social media, no longer has the influence it once had, and why the Conservatives can no longer rely on the advantage of the majority of the press being sympathetic to them, and the sums thrown at Facebook were, to all intents and purposes, largely wasted.
Well, it's interesting because it was allegedly Facebook advertising that won it for the Tories in 2015. And that was allegedly how they managed to get over the line. This time, interestingly, Facebook users are older. It's youth don't particularly use Facebook. Snapchat and Instagram perhaps are more, you know, if you want to aim for youth votes, that's better. I have mixed feelings about this. I am, you know, the press has always been weighted to the right.
Yes,
Corbyn got a rough time in the right wing press, but so did Ed Miliband. And so, in a way, I am delighted that the increasingly squalid rag that is the Daily Mail has not won a general election. I'm really, really pleased about that. And I hope that Paul Dacre's downfall is swift and definite. However, and The Sun as well, also not a fan of The Sun for various reasons, Liverpool related and otherwise. So in a way, I'm really pleased that British democracy is not merely the plaything of the press anymore. Having said this, I had personal experience of what happens when people don't rely on official sources, and when rumours are spread online on social media, then become credence. There were lots of people tweeting about the fact that Hastings and Rye had gone to 3 or 4 recounts and that Amber Rudd was asking for them. None of this was true. What happened was by the time people were talking about there being a recount, I had a friend there who was reporting for the Press Association, who was texting us to tell us what was going on, because she was in the gallery, she wasn't on the floor. So our people that were in the gallery, I was getting contacts from them, and She said, I said, is it true there's been a recount? She said they haven't, they only started the first count 20 minutes ago. And one polling district had been recounted, I think, by this point. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, everything else was the case. There was only one recount in Hastings and Rye because they said, oh, Amber was losing and they suddenly found 300 votes. Nonsense. Mm-hmm. Amber Rudd won the first count by 330, I think, or 334. The Labour agent asked for a recount, ordered a recount, which I think is, you know, it's fair enough mm-hmm. when it was that close, because then media perception, it comes about, you know, Amber Rudd holding her seat is very different to Amber Rudd holds her seat after a recount. So I thought that was spot on by the agent. I thought that was exactly what they should have done. And then after that recount, the Tories won by 3-4-6, so it went slightly up, and so Labour rightly conceded as they should have done. The reason why that spread round, there was thought that there was either a rogue reporter or a rogue kind of junior expert that didn't understand. I'm putting expert in inverted commas because then apparently there was someone as well watching the live stream of the count, and they didn't understand that someone sorting out votes on one table, that wasn't a recount, that was something different. So people that think they're experts in it all allow those falsehoods to be spread online. I spent about half an hour correcting people because I know it is a completely useless activity, but equally I just think that I am concerned about the fact that I do think freedom of the press is very important. And I think that in an age where we have to deal with so many falsehoods and so much inaccuracy and in very uncertain times, I think that properly sourced reporting is really, really important. And people will talk about how, you know, Squawk Box and the Canary, which are kind of left-wing Corbyn supporting sites, you know, I loathe them because much of their reporting is clickbaity and inaccurate. And there was a really good piece about the Canary ages ago by Marie Leconte on BuzzFeed about, you know, the how the pay structures work and how it is basically completely revolving around clickbait. Having said that, maybe they're you know, them and Evolve Politics, which had footage of Amber Rudd shutting down the independent candidate in Hastings who wanted to talk about Saudi Arabia, maybe those things did make a difference. And to have more balance, I think, is a really good thing. And I would very much like it if all the national press wasn't so heavily weighted in one direction. And I miss the independent in that respect, because that always genuinely was. Having said that, I don't want this to be at the cost of a lack of accurate reporting and accurate sources, because I think that all it does is, you know, I resent people then making decisions on false information. And yes, you know, some of the stuff that the right wing press said was, you know, was false and not true and that sort of thing. But I don't want to end up living in a world where social media means that we are constantly fed information that is not based on facts. I think that is very dangerous.
Apart from appearing on Facebook and Twitter, might we see or hear you anywhere else this week?
Well, if you're really good, you might do. I think agreeing to DJ on a Friday evening after the general election, that was a bit of a tactical error. Yeah. But anyway, I know. But so I'm doing Indie Wonderland this week. That's happening on Wednesday evening from 8 to 10pm, where we do increasingly themed shows. I'm not sure if I will do that again this week, but we do indie, alt rock and miscellaneous. And then next Saturday, which will be Saturday, the whatever it is, help me, Terence. Is it Saturday
the 17th?
Yeah,
yes.
Saturday the 17th. That will be the return of the Saturday Social. And I don't actually have any public engagements between them, which is just as well, because I've spent the last 48 hours in pyjamas and I've very much enjoyed that. So yeah, that's where we are.
Thanks to our very own answer to the West Lothian question. That's executive producer,
yes,
Rona.
Hi, Ro.
So here's a tune produced by Mick Jones of The Clash to take us out, Jules.
Yes, absolutely. And this is a tune which I rather enjoyed. I felt that, you know, it might well be time for heroes, as this tune says, in the next few weeks if we're due to have another general election. It's by the Libertines. It's taken from their debut album, Up the Bracket. As you say, largely produced by Mick Jones, that album, and this was. And this is Time for Heroes.
Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks, set the night on fire, won't bleed. Truncheons and shields, you know I cherish you, my love. But the Zoom has spread nasty disease around town. You cut on the houses with your trousers down. A head rush, and in the bush, yeah.
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.